carried less weight than those people who were famous models, or athletes, or actors on a sitcom. Nicole seemed satisfied with Tamika's answer. In hindsight, Tamika felt the woman was attempting to goad her into saying more, because it made for better footage, not because she disagreed with her. Even so, she was rattled at the end, and when the interviewer wrapped things up with, "And can I just say that I love your hair in that fur drape? So fun!" Tamika wasn't sure if she was being mocked. "Guess we'll see when it goes live," she thought. "Welcome to life in the spotlight." Well, if it brought in some more revenue, it was worth it. She didn't need the Huffington Post's endorsement to know she was doing good, necessary work. She was glad they'd asked her. "Why do you do this?" It forced her to answer it for herself, something she hadn't really done before. She approached the day's work with a new buoyancy, but even Audrey's whining about her sorry personal life and how the people at Fox News got paid more than she did could not dampen. "What's that thing around your neck?" Marvin had finally shown up and was peering at her, leaning with one hand on her desk like he wasn't sure of his balance. Tamika snatched the fur off and tossed it onto her jacket. "Nothing," she said. "I was covering a stain." "Right," said Marvin, nodding with greater seriousness than the remark justified. "Got it." Tamika wrinkled her nose. "You stoned man, because I told you about coming to work like that." "No, no," said Marvin, dropping into a bizarre half-crouch and putting his hands up in a half-assed surrender pose, as he always did when he felt threatened. "Swear to God, it's just, you know, passive."
"Passive?"
"Yeah, my roommate had the bong going this morning, and I may have caught some of the collateral vibe, you know?" Tamika gave him a dubious frown. "You up to installing the new firewall?" she asked.
"Totally," said Marvin. "Well, within my powers. I'll have it done before you can say firewall."
He paused, reflecting upon this.
"But you might not want to say it for, like, 2 hours.
"Deal," Tamika said.
"Oh, and there's a package for you," he added,
producing something about the size of a shoebox, wrapped in brown paper and tied with thin twine.
"The doorman just handed it to me. He said an old guy came by before you got in."
He placed the parcel on Tamika's desk. Her name was written in unsteady block capitals in magic marker. There was no return address or sign that it had been through the post. Not everyone was a fan of what the office produced. She usually received belligerent explanations in the mail rather than actual hate mail. But she'd had her share of death threats from people angry because she'd picked apart or ridiculed the assumptions they considered true or even sacred. She held the package gingerly, weighing it. Too light for a bomb, she thought, but not for anthrax or ricin or, more likely, talcum powder, which would shut the office down until they could get an all-clear from the health department. "I'm going to open this outside," she said, fishing scissors and rubber gloves from her desk drawer. "You want me to come with?" Marvin asked. Audrey, Tamika noted, was making no such offer, and eyed the parcel warily.
"Nah, I'm good," she answered. "If I'm not back in 5 minutes, call in the hazmat team."
Marvin looked unsure.
"Is the number in your Rolodex thingy?" he asked.
"I was kidding, Marvin," said Tamika, picking up the package and stalking out of the room with a pointed look at Audrey.
"Hey,"
said the reporter, with a better version of Marvin's hands-up defensive gesture.
"I just work here. You don't pay me enough to get blown up."
"Yeah," muttered Tamika, as she pushed through the door and into the stairwell, drawing her scarlet raincoat tight to her body.
"That's what I figured."
She didn't really believe the package was dangerous, but she crossed to the square across the street and chose a bench away from two old people who were exercising their dogs. She opened the parcel carefully, donning the rubber gloves and slitting the paper, then turning the box upside down at arm's length. No telltale white powder trickled out. When she lifted the lid, she found only a notebook. It was blue, hard-bound, with a cloth cover stained with age and use. Inside the cover was an envelope, thick with heavy stationery covered in spidery script. "Dear Miss Mars," the letter began, "I hope to be talking you through the contents of this book in person, since there is much to be explained. But in case I am not able to, I wanted you to understand something. The contents of this book are extremely important. I am confident that it will change your life and your sense of many things. It is also extremely dangerous. There are people who would kill me to prevent you from reading it, and may attempt to kill you for doing so. For that I apologize. I will trust your judgment as to whether you will take that risk, though I am confident in my regard for your sense of ethical responsibility. Read. Investigate all I have to say. Check it. Subject it to your most rigorous debunction. Then call me. My time is short, even if no one tries to make it shorter. Until then, I am sincerely yours, Jersey Aaron Stern." His name was followed by a phone number. Tamika wasn't sure what to make of it. It screamed conspiracy theory nonsense, especially the paranoid hinting about lives in danger, which was one of the major hallmarks of the genre. But the writing itself gave her pause. It was an old man's writing, unsteady, but sophisticated, as was the phrasing. Most of what she received was a train wreck of small and capital letters, third-grade spelling, and text message punctuation. This felt different. She opened the notebook, carefully, feeling its age, and startled to find that it contained more of the same longhand script, though the penmanship looked younger, more confident than the letter she'd just read. There were pages and pages of it, occasionally broken by little sketches and diagrams. It was clearly a journal, all entries carefully dated. She flipped to the front and caught her breath. The first entry, laid out in blue ink, the desiccated pages stained and smeared with dirt, or even old blood, was labeled Krakow, Poland, 1939. No way. "You okay there, Tamika?" She looked up to find Marvin standing over her. "You look kind of spooked. You need me to call those hazmat guys or something?" She hesitated, staring at the first entry. "You know what, Marvin?" she said at last. "I'm really not sure." 5. Jersey. Krakow, Poland, September 1939. That date marks where it started. I am writing this entry a decade later, in America, and, as you can see, in English. I will write more from here as it happens. But my story begins before what I think of as the present. So I'm going back to my childhood in Poland. That, as I say, was when things started, though I did not know it at the time. I was 10 years old when the Nazis came. Some of my family had already fled, but most did not go far enough. They went to other parts of Europe, and the war eventually overtook them. I was told I had an uncle who made it to England, and a cousin who set out for America, though I do not know if she made it all the way. I lost touch with them, as I lost touch with all my family. As far as I know, I am the only one who survived. I remember the first days of the war only vaguely, and my memories are confused by things I read or saw later. I know that the day before the fighting started, I sat with a Polish soldier, a little man who smiled at me and ruffled my hair. He was the driver of a kind of little tank. It had a machine gun, and it seemed to me that it was the greatest, most terrible weapon imaginable. I do not know what happened to the man and his machine, but I think they were probably both destroyed within a day or two of our conversation. The Germans came fast and strong. There were stories of our soldiers armed with lances, riding against the German tanks on horseback. I do not think the stories were true, but I know that after a week, the war was largely over for us, or rather the fighting was over. The war went on much longer. Parts of me are still fighting it. The Russians came from the north and east, and the Nazis from the west. I lived in a village close to the Czech border, surrounded by green forests. Some of the men from our area, including soldiers who had not been killed in the initial onslaught, were taken to work in the Stoda factories in Pilsen. But Jews like us were considered incapable of such work. At first, it was just strange. And for a few days, it seemed that Mama, Papa, Ishmael, and I were the only people still living in the village, watched over by hundreds of German soldiers. I am sure my parents were very frightened, but they hid it as best they could. My brother and I were more confused than we were scared. Children, I think, are tougher than adults realize. Children adjust. In our case, we lived for days, weeks, I'm not sure. We had mainly hunger and isolation to complain of. Things changed when we had to leave the house we had lived in all our lives. But even as we were packed onto the train to Krakow, Papa managed to make it feel like an adventure, a kind of holiday. It wasn't, of course. It was a version of hell. Poverty and want are one thing in the country, but they are something entirely different in a city, particularly when you are packed into a few square blocks with thousands of others, many of whom were in worse condition than we were. I was still under 12 years of age then, so I did not have to wear an armband, and I remember feeling a peculiarly childish and conflicted form of shame at this. I was embarrassed for my parents and brother, who wore the yellow star, and relieved that I did not have to wear it. But I also carried a deeper, more insidious self-loathing, because I was not standing with them. These feelings only deepened when my brother and I were taken away. Ishmael was 3 years older than I, a strong and solid boy, who knew more than he confessed to me about what was happening in our corner of the world. He had black hair and high cheekbones in a pale face, with eyes as dark as pools at night. I idolized him, and he, for his part, protected me. "This will be over soon, little Jersey," he told me every night. "You see if it won't. And when the Germans run screaming from the British bombers, you and me, we'll chase them out, laughing at the tops of our lungs." But the British didn't come. The war went on. And though the Russians changed sides, nothing changed in Poland. It became impossible to remember things that had ever been different, or imagine that the world would ever go back to what it had been. I saw it in my mama's eyes, in her drawn, haggard face, and in my father's slow watchfulness when he looked at us. His life had been ambushed, redirected, and it would never get back to what it should be. My parents worked long hours in a munitions factory, coming home exhausted, their hands red from the chemicals. We had been in the Krakow ghetto almost a year when the trucks came. They arrived early one morning in March. It was bitter cold, but everyone crowded into the square to see what was going on, in case there was food or other supplies. But the trucks were empty, except for the guards. They were there to make selections for labor camps, packing 8 men into the back of each truck. My family hid, but when they came the next day, and the day after that, we began to wonder if the camps could be worse than where we were living, huddled with another family, and what had once been a tool shed in someone's garden. The walls were a single plank thick, and even with every blanket and coat we owned, the nights were unendurably cold. There was no toilet, no running water, and precious little food. One night, after a tiny meal of potatoes and pig fat, shared with 2 other families, our stomachs achingly hollow, my brother decided he had had enough. "At least in the labor camps, they'll feed us," Ishmael urged that night, speaking to me in a hoarse whisper as we lay huddled for warmth. "I can't stay here any longer.
I'll go mad. I'll go work and get fed. Then I'll come back. I'm not afraid of work. It has to be better than here.
It did not occur to him, or to me, that we would not be brought back to our families. I often wonder if my father overheard us. He said so little those days that it wasn't always easy to tell whether he was awake or when he was asleep. The following day, when the trucks came, Ishmael pushed to the front. He was, as I said, a big boy for his age, almost a man, and one of the officers spotted him immediately.
"My brother, too," he insisted, pulling me forward through the throng.
The officer looked me over disparagingly, but shrugged. He didn't care who they took. I remember looking across the square, sorting through the anxious, drawn faces for my mother or father, but couldn't see them. I never saw them again. Within months, the ghetto was purged. Many were killed in the streets. Others were herded onto trains and packed off on their one-way journey to Auschwitz. We knew none of this. The full scale of it didn't register for years. The horror of the so-called final solution was unimaginable to us. Even now, when I read about it, I find myself wrestling to visualize the enormity of the thing, even though I lived through it. Everyone knows the big number, 6 million dead. But that is not a figure the mind grasps easily. I suspect that for some, when placed in the context of the war, and the length of time it all took, and the sheer geography of it all, 6 million dead seems somehow, I don't know, ordinary, understandable. Certainly it is a kind of abstract knowledge, a fact without faces. But the terrible mathematics get worse when you think small. At Belzec, at its busiest, Jews were unloaded from train cars at a fake railway station building, where they were stripped and their belongings confiscated, before being escorted into buildings for showers, 200 at a time. They were then gassed with carbon monoxide, or Zyklon B. The process took about 30 minutes. Afterwards, dentists removed any gold teeth from the corpses with hammers, collecting as much as 2 cupfuls for melting. The bodies were buried in shallow graves, but the smell was said to carry for 10 miles, so cremation became the order of the day. At Auschwitz, the ovens burned constantly, consuming 1,000 bodies a day. Somewhere among all those corpses were my parents. I didn't know it for certain for another 2.5 years, but the sense of something lost hung over Ishmael and me the very first night we were away from them. The trucks carrying my brother and me had left the city behind and rumbled on into the mountains, heading southwest towards the Czech border. Familiar ground for us, so that in spite of our exhaustion, our hunger, and our uncertainty, we felt the thrill of returning to land we had known as children before the war. We looked at each other, grinning madly for the first time in months, as we peered through the window slits in the truck walls and saw hills and church towers we knew. It was only when the sun began to set that we realized how far we had come and how unlikely it was that we would be going back to Krakow and our parents any time soon. I asked the guard, speaking in my faltering German, the one talent I had been able to use for my family, when we would go back, and he just sighed, almost as miserable to be there as we were. "Wenn der Krieg vorbei ist," he said, "when the war is over." We slept in bunks and canvas tents. It was cold, but no worse than it had been in the ghetto. Ishmael was wrong about the food. That first night, we were given a small piece of black bread and a fragment of cheese and told it was to last us until lunchtime the following day. Ishmael was first incredulous and then furious at how stupid we had been to volunteer for something so awful. He shouted at a guard and said that we wanted to go back to Warsaw. The soldier struck him on the side of his head with the butt of his rifle, and Ishmael fell heavily to the ground, unconscious. As I knelt over him, weeping, a spider-thin man, a fellow Jew, crouched beside me and put his hand over the swelling bruise on my brother's temple.
"That was a stupid thing to do," he remarked. "If you want to survive for any length of time here, you and your idiot brother will learn to keep your mouths shut."
"Will he be all right?" I asked.
"He'll have a hell of a headache when he comes around, but yes, I think so. Unless he does it again. You don't get second chances here. And to make the point, so that you both remember it, I'm going to eat his cheese."
He did so, sourly and without relish. But I was too drained by our predicament to muster any real outrage.
"Where are we?" I managed.
"They call it the Wenceslas Mine," he said.
"What will we do here?"
"It's a mine," he said bitterly. "We dig." But that, as we learned over the next few awful days, weeks, and months, was only partly true. We dug and tunneled, but we also built, pouring concrete and pushing the wheelbarrows of rubble out until our hands bled and we couldn't stand. We toiled beneath the earth like moles, constructing we knew not what. And sometimes we wept for those we had lost, and for what we had become. That there was more to come, stranger and more hideous than anything we had seen so far, we could not have imagined.
6. Allen, Camp Leatherneck Marine, Helmand Province, Afghanistan. He had debriefed after missions 100 times. He knew the drill, and usually nothing fazed him. This time was different. This time he felt the weight of shame and confusion, and with them came the long tale of dread. Major Allen Young was a Marine pilot, to the very marrow of his bones. That identity was encoded in his DNA. It was who he was, and he felt it ending, and there was nothing he could do to stop that from happening. The damage was done. He had filed his report the moment he landed at Leatherneck, thankful for the armed escort that had carried him away from Barry's towering rage at the landing strip. The MARSOC team had lost 3 men in the barrage from the helicopters. 4 survivors had to be stretchered out, and 2 of them were in surgery with shrapnel wounds. Allen's fault. It wasn't, of course. He knew that with his head, but in his gut, his failure burned like hot metal. Almost as bad was knowing that the more he tried to explain what had happened, the more he would jeopardize his position. Mechanical failure was one thing, but coming under the influence of an unidentifiable object? That would blow his career in a heartbeat and land him in the psych ward. He had already decided to say nothing about it, to make it sound like he'd just had a weapons malfunction due, perhaps, to a software glitch, one which, of course, was now fixed and undetectable. Allen chewed his lower lip, his one nervous tick. The moment the bogies had opened fire, the strange glowing sphere had vanished, streaking upwards at unimaginable speed and vanishing into darkness. Their work done, the enemy helos had vanished over the hills, winking in and out of radar like ghosts before the Nighthawks could engage them. If anyone had seen the strange object in the sky, they weren't saying. The debriefing building, a sensitive compartmentalized information facility, SCIF for short, was a low cluster of offices plastered in desert yellow. The operations command team was familiar. 2 lieutenants and a captain, who Allen had seen routinely for months, though today they were stiff, formal, and reluctant to make eye contact. He felt like he'd been called to the principal's office, something he hadn't felt since his first days at MCAS Cherry Point. Under other circumstances, it might have been funny. But it wasn't. He'd filed his report immediately following the mission. The duty officers had sent him back to his quarters to rest while they reviewed the details. ordering him to return at 0900. He'd slept badly, playing and replaying the events of the night in his head, looking for something that might plausibly explain what had happened that night over the mountains. In his report, he'd said that the weapon systems had failed, and that he'd been temporarily blinded by a bright light. Perhaps it had been some kind of flare launched by one of the enemy helicopters, or some new kind of drone designed to illuminate the target area, there simply to light the position, and his problems in the Harrier were unrelated. If it was equipment failure, he would know soon enough, because the ground crew was going over his bird to determine what went wrong. They would have a preliminary report by morning, maybe sooner. Alan considered this as he shaved. His blue-green eyes were bloodshot with tiredness, the sockets shadowed, his always lean face looking more than usually drawn and hollow. "You look like hell, Major," he observed. He ran his hands through his short brown hair, noting the way it was graying at the temples, then hurried to the skiff, hoping to God he didn't meet anyone who might ask how things had gone. But everyone would know. You didn't lose three of your own without the whole base knowing. "Please be seated, Major Young, sir," said the intel officer, closing the door behind him. "I'm Captain Thwaite. We've met before." "About 100 times, thought Alan. "Captain," he said. "And this is Lieutenant Jonah," the captain continued, nodding to the woman sitting next to him, who did not look up. "And Lieutenant Simmons," the burly officer by the door. No one was smiling. Alan nodded and took the proffered seat. The captain's formality bothered him. The intel guys were always careful. But this was different. There was an air of caution that suggested everyone was covering their ass. Alan's heart sank. He could be reliving last night's fiasco for months, possibly even years, in depositions and reports and interviews. Captain Thwaite opened a manila folder, rotated it, and pushed it across the table towards him. "This is your account of the events last night," he said. "Before we start, I just want to be clear. We're looking for a clear picture of what happened, putting your account together with the data gathered from drones, AWACS, satellite surveillance, and other witness accounts. No one is accusing you of anything, and your record, which is exemplary, is duly noted. Is there anything you would like to add to the report you've already made? Or change?" The hesitation between those last two sentences had been only a fraction of a second, but it was loaded with meaning. "No, Captain," he said. Another pause, icy despite the still mounting heat of the day. "Nothing at all? Are you sure about that, Major Young?" asked the lieutenant opposite him. He considered her question for a half second. Alan had seen her, a week ago, at an off-base restaurant frequented by a British regiment. She had looked, as much as possible in her multicam utility uniform, glamorous, sexy even, in makeup that pushed the limits of what was considered acceptable. She had seemed lighthearted, even a little flirty then. There was no trace of that playfulness now, though she had the decency to avoid his gaze when he said, "No, Lieutenant, I stand by my report." The captain produced another document, slightly dog-eared. He considered it thoughtfully and edged it towards Alan, moving as if in slow motion. "This is the preliminary report on your aircraft from an examination conducted in the early hours of this morning," he said. "A test pilot will take the plane up later today to do further live tests on its weapon systems. But as you can see, the first pass engineering report says that all systems seem to be operating normally. The flight data recorders show no record of any attempt on your part to engage said systems during the mission last night. Can you offer an explanation for that?" "No, Captain, I cannot," said Alan. "Though the loss of power to the systems, which I outlined, would explain why there's no record of the attempt to deploy. It was offline." "That would be the Sidewinder you say you attempted to launch at the enemy helicopter?" said the captain. "Yes. The LGBs worked perfectly.
The systems only went down when the helicopters appeared.
You think they were somehow jamming you?
I don't know, Captain. But I think that possibility should be thoroughly examined, said Alan, opting for the same formal professionalism as his interrogators.
I doubt my launch systems failing at the exact time the 35 showed up is a coincidence.
Yes, said the captain levelly. I would agree. Though I'm unsure of any system that could affect your weapon systems, but not your flight controls.
Alan shifted in his chair. He could feel the heat rising in his face.
They said they weren't accusing him of anything, but there was more than confusion in the room. There was skepticism.
The lieutenant silently moved another sheet of paper in front of the captain. They did not look at each other, but Alan felt that the action had been discussed, planned. Something was about to happen.
"Do you recall what you said over the radio last night, Major?" said the captain, looking up.
"Not word for word," Alan began, but the captain waved the rest away.
"Of course not, Major," he cut in. "But do you recall saying, and I quote, 'I have an unidentified bogey in visual range, configuration unknown. I think it's disrupting my weapon systems.' Do you recall saying that?"
Alan stiffened.
"I think what I meant was,"
he began, but again, the captain interjected.
"Do you recall saying that, sir?"
"Not precisely."
"Are you doubting the accuracy of the cockpit voice recorder?"
the lieutenant chimed in.
"No," Alan said quickly. "I just don't recall using those exact words."
"Well," said the captain, managing a mirthless smile, "I can assure you, Major, that you did, and I'm wondering what you meant by them."
"Well, as I said," Alan began, "I was wondering if maybe something on the helicopters."
"But you don't say helicopter," the captain pressed. "You say unidentified bogey, configuration unknown, singular. So it seems you weren't referring to the three helicopters."
He let the sentence hang in the air.
Alan said nothing.
"Did you see another aircraft last night, Major, other than the three helicopters you failed to engage when requested to do so by your ground team?"
Alan felt cornered, and he had to fight down the urge to come out fighting. There was nothing he could say that wouldn't make the situation worse.
"I feel like I need legal counsel or something," he said.
"This is a routine debriefing, not a court of law, Major," said the lieutenant.
Alan's lip buckled into a derisive smile. There was nothing routine about what was happening this morning. But then there'd been nothing routine about last night, either. He considered. It wasn't their fault that they had to probe him to get a sense of what really happened. If another pilot had told him the same story, would he have believed it? Probably not. He would have guessed that this was some trumped-up horseshit to cover some more shameful failure. Panic, incompetence, even cowardice. These were the words floating in his interviewers' heads. Ugly words which, if they found their way out of their heads and into any formal account of last night's debacle, would cost him his career at very least.
"I did everything I could," he said. It was true, but it sounded lame and desperate. In that instant, Alan knew he had made a mistake. He should tell him everything. Let the chips fall where they may. Maybe the AWACS had picked up some anomalous signal which they'd examined more closely, if he said exactly what he thought he had seen. His silence was making his situation worse.
"Why don't we take a break and reconvene this afternoon?" said the lieutenant. "You can think things over. We can talk to the survivors from the ground force. Get the test flight completed, and then we can talk later. See if we can connect these dots better."
The survivors.
Alan nodded.
"For the record, Major," said the captain, "Flight Command has asked that you remain grounded until our investigation is concluded. Until tomorrow, then. Major, would you wait here, please?"
His debriefers left the room, and for a moment, Alan just sat there, wondering what the hell he had been thinking. Maybe if he went after them, told them he wanted to change his story, this might all start making some kind of sense. He got to his feet, but before he could get to the door, it opened,
and a man came in. He was middle-aged, lean, and fit-looking, wearing a trim charcoal-colored suit, in spite of the desert heat. "My name is Special Agent Martin Hatcher," he said, opening a folding wallet and slapping it onto the table so that the three letters printed on the card inside could be read. CIA. "I'll be taking over this interrogation." "This is a Marine Corps matter," Alan said. "You have no authority." But Martin Hatcher was inflappable. "NCIS are aware of my presence," he said. "I can wait if you'd like to call your superiors," he remarked, moving around the table until he faced Alan, sitting in the captain's former seat. "But that will only waste everybody's time, and you'll still find that I have all the authority I need." His tone was conversational, his manner professional but pleasant, as if what he was doing was ordinary. Today's business, a minor shift from normal operations. Alan stared at him, saying nothing. "Major Young," he went on, taking an envelope from his briefcase, "I have something requiring your immediate signature." He opened the envelope and offered Alan a single sheet of paper, a neatly typed letter addressed to Alan's commanding officer. The first sentence read, "I, Major Alan Young, do hereby resign my commission in the Marine Corps, effective immediately." Alan looked up. The CIA officer gave him a level stare, then plucked a ballpoint pen from his shirt pocket and held it across the table. "Now, please, Major," he said. 7. Jennifer. London. It took Jennifer 3 days to get back to London. She had to bribe 2 different sets of South African traffic cops en route to Johannesburg Airport. They could spot a rental a mile off and tailed you until they saw something they could claim as an infraction, usually someone straying over the solid line dividing the highway. Normally, she was painstakingly careful and alert to police presence, but she was driving in a furious fog that seemed to thicken with each mile the more she considered her father's typically high-handed bullshit. It was so like him, meddling, subverting what she did, what she worked for, what she believed in. She had called once, leaving an angry voicemail that said she was on her way, but refused to say when she'd arrive. The call completed, she had turned off her phone and stowed it deep in her luggage, so that she couldn't be tempted to try to reach him again. What she had to say would wait until she was standing in front of him, and she had spent most of her journey crafting in her head precisely what those words would be. On the outskirts of the Johannesburg, skirting a black township edged with rusty corrugated iron, and shelters made of oil barrels and polythene sheeting, she moved into the center lane to avoid herds of wandering cattle and goats. It still had to brake hard when a baboon ran across the road through heavy traffic. She was inside of the city's metropolitan sprawl, but it still felt like what her father considered third world. And people like him made it so. She didn't hate her father, she was sure of that, but of late it had become harder to distinguish the man from his work, and there was no question that she had hated his work for a long time. Edward Quinn was a financier. That was how he introduced himself, saying it with a modest twinkle that implied he could, with a click of his mouse, bring 6 small nations to the brink of bankruptcy. But it wasn't a big deal. If money made the world turn, then it was people like her father who controlled how fast it turned. And while she could live with the sickening profits he reaped in the process, she'd learned, as a child, to loathe the idea that channeling money to one place meant taking it from somewhere else. The tasteful excess she had grown up with, the sprawling Hampstead mansion, the Tuscan villa, the scattering of elegantly appointed apartments and hotel suites in every corner of the world, the Jaguars and BMWs, her father's Savile Row suits, which cost more than most people in Swaziland made in a year. It had all become emblematic of everything that was wrong with the world. For years now, she had vacillated between her moral outrage at the source of her father's wealth and the idea that she could put some of it to good use, despite the harm his corporate cronies had done to the world. But she was off balance now. His meddling in her work couldn't go on. She would sit him down, look him in the eye, and tell him. She was tired of being held hostage. She wanted no more of his money. Ever. The irony that she had used her father's credit card to buy an airline ticket, first class, was not lost on her. Life was about to get very difficult. It would be some time before she could get back to the kind of work she saw as her calling. Her cosmic duty to balance the damage her father had done to the world. People managed, she told herself, as she boarded the British Airways flight to Heathrow. She was educated, accomplished. She would be able to find work, good benevolent work, that paid enough that she could cut her ties to her father, and still put enough bread on the table to get by. It would be an adjustment, but she could do it. If it meant losing her fiscal safety net, it also meant she would gain her independence. She extended her pod-like recliner all the way back, reveling in its luxurious privacy, comfortable knowing this was the last time she would do so. From here on, Jennifer Quinn would fly coach, and rarely. She landed shortly after dawn, on a typically cold, damp English morning. She felt strange returning to her past, considering all that she had gained and lost since she was last home. Maybe she would go for a run in the rain after she got home, clear her head. She normally ran every other day without fail, and the cramped confinement had left her body feeling like a compressed spring. She had not left her flight details on his voicemail, so he wouldn't be able to send a car to get her. Her plan was to take a series of trains and buses, like an ordinary person. So she was surprised to see Reg Deacon, her father's personal assistant, waiting for her just beyond customs and immigration. For a second, she watched the man her father called his old retainer, as he scanned the faces of passengers emerging from customs and immigration, with something like contempt. Then her surprise at his being there at all deepened and grew more complicated. Deacon was a chief of staff, and his duties spanned a range of possibilities, both domestic and professional. They did not, however, include chauffeuring. Deacon was in his early 60s, a tough, unreadable man who had ghosted Jennifer's entire life, but who gave little away. As a girl, she had liked him, but she had distanced herself from him more and more over the years, seeing him as another cog in her father's great machine. This morning, he looked tired, drawn, and there was something in his face she had never seen before. Then the man's eyes found her and locked on. A flash of recognition was immediately replaced with a kind of sigh as his body sagged, his face hollowing, his eyes full of sadness and apprehension. Something had happened. Something bad. For a moment, they just stared at each other, oblivious to the milling travelers, and something passed between them. Jennifer's anger evaporated in the sudden, absolute, certain realization that her father was dead. And then the world went away, and she was not aware of herself enough to be amazed by her own tears. Deacon had brought her a cheese and onion pastry for breakfast, because she had loved them when she was a kid. Sitting in the car parked outside of Heathrow's Terminal 3, she took a half-hearted bite, and then, though it tasted of nothing, devoured it hungrily, washing it down with a bottle of orange juice. "Now, before we go home," said Deacon carefully, floating that last word uncertainly, as if he didn't know if it would comfort or distress her, "I wanted to ask you how you would like to handle some legal matters." She gave him a blank look, as if he were speaking Siswati or Zulu, and she had to grope around for a metal dictionary. "Legal matters? Though we could not reach you, your father's unfortunate demise—" "Suicide," she interrupted.
trying the word out to see if it sounded more plausible when she said it. It didn't.
Quite, said Deacon, with studied caution.
He was treating her like a bomb that might go off at any moment.
It has set things in motion. Which is to say, he hesitated, when ordinary people die, the world goes on, and those who knew the deceased are given time to grieve. But your father was anything but ordinary. A great deal of important business depended upon him. His absence, particularly since it was so sudden and unexpected, has left many matters in need of resolution.
I don't care about any of that, she said flatly, watching the rain, which had begun to streak the car's tinted windows.
Which is understandable, Deacon said, but a lot of other people do.
I don't need to remind you of the scale of your father's business involvements.
I said, you don't care, I know, Deacon pressed, but wheels are already in motion to resolve those matters left in limbo by your father's absence.
She looked at him.
His death, Deacon conceded.
So, she said, what does this have to do with me? It was a stupid remark. She had always avoided thinking about what she would do when her father's money one day became hers. And she had always assumed that was about defiance, a refusal to be interested in what he had worked so hard to accumulate. Suddenly, she wondered if she had avoided the subject, because it meant acknowledging that he would die, and she would be alone.
You are his sole surviving heir, said Deacon. Though I'm sure your father's business dealings are of little interest to you, you must be present at the opening of the will, which is going to explicate those dealings, as well as more personal matters. The lawyers are already assembled at Steading's. I'm happy to send them away for today, but matters must be dealt with in a reasonably prompt.
It's fine, said Jennifer quickly.
Fine?
I'll do it today, as soon as we get home. Deacon considered her gravely.
Are you sure?
Yes, she said, forcing a smile, which almost buckled into something else, before she could turn her face to the window.
Best to get it over.
But reading the will got nothing over. Quite the contrary. Jennifer sat in the drawing room at Steading's, the Hampshire mansion, its French windows looking out over formal gardens and a ring of trees, which shrouded the house from prying eyes, avoiding the eyes of the formally dressed lawyers and the watchful businessmen who had been assembled to hear what Edward Quinn had thought fit to do with his numerous weighty assets. Some of the men were known to her. Two or three had been shadowy features of her life from as long ago as she could remember, but they had all become part of the world on which she had turned her back, and she met their murmurs of condolence with chill politeness. She was the youngest person in the room by a good 2 decades, and the only woman. They were all, of course, white. Herman Salzberg, who she remembered hiding from as a kid, because his almost skeletal face and hands had given her nightmares, was eyeing her with vague surprise, as if he had forgotten her existence entirely. He was still hollow-cheeked and lean to the point of cadaverousness, and when he offered her a hand to shake, it was dry as paper, and she could feel every bone and sinew, so that for a moment she was 8 years old again and desperate to run back to her room and close the door. At the opposite end of the spectrum was Ronald Harrington Smythe, a man so large he seemed to fill an entire corner of the drawing room all by himself. He was bald, and his bullet-shaped head emerged from the collar of his massive shirt, like the tip of a great cone. There were plenty others she didn't know, including one who came in just as proceedings were about to begin, younger than the rest, with raven-black hair which, at least by the standards of the room, was positively disheveled and gave his finely cut suit a rakish look. His eyes flashed around the room, lingered on her for a fraction of a second, then moved to where Deacon, flanked by lawyers, had begun to speak.
"We are here today," he began, sounding like a minister, "to consider the last will and testament of our friend, colleague, and, to Jennifer,
father, Edward Quinn, a special proviso of which is the deceased's request that you all be here, whether or not you stand to benefit directly.
Jennifer caught an elderly man stealing a glance in her direction. She ignored it.
Let's just get this over with, she thought for the 50th time that morning, and we can all go our separate ways.
Deacon continued with the formalities. To her right, a man with diamond-studded cufflinks shifted in his seat. And then one of the lawyers was unsealing a large envelope and reading in a thin, wavering voice.
Edward Quinn's will, spelling out all of his holdings, is a long and complex document, because his interests were numerous, the executor said. But at its core, it is remarkably simple, because Mr. Quinn made a substantial codicil to amend it 3 days before he died.
There was a subtle change in the room, as if the air had been charged with electricity. Brows furrowed, spines stiffened, pens, which had been scribbling on paper, stilled, and all eyes locked onto the lawyer. They had not expected this, and Jennifer, to her surprise, found herself interested, even amused. It seemed the old man had one last trick up his sleeve.
"We will go through the details in a moment," said the lawyer, "and I'm sure you will have a lot of questions. But the core change is summed up in the introductory sentence to the codicil, witnessed by myself and one other, which reads thus: I, Edward Quinn, being of sound mind and body, as attested by competent authorities and witnesses, do hereby bequeath, excepting those few gifts made to my staff, and in particular to Reginald Deacon, all my possessions, all capital, stocks, shares and properties, all assets, partnerships and business interests under my ownership, including those seats on executive boards which are mine to control, and retaining to them the full executive power I have wielded in life, to my daughter, Jennifer.
8. Tamika, New York. Marvin led Tamika back toward the office with his usual bobbing gait, jiving vaguely to some private soundtrack only he could hear. They were met on the sidewalk outside the door by Audrey Stanhope, DeBunction's pit bull reporter. She looked excited.
"Bomb scare," she announced, delighted. "We're supposed to clear out for the day until the premises are rendered secure. And yeah, that's a quote."
"From who?" Tamika demanded. She adjusted her crimson coat, feeling conspicuous. It made her feel like a stop sign.
"Hunky bomb squad guy," said Audrey. "Didn't give me his name. Yet."
She fluffed her blonde hair hopefully.
"Bomb scare?" Marvin whined. "Oh, man. Harsh. We really can't go in?"
"Really," said Audrey. "But they want to talk to us before we leave."
"They?" Marvin echoed. "You mean cops? Oh, man."
Like a lot of stoners, Marvin had a deep-seated paranoia about the police.
"I'm going nowhere," said Tamika. "I've got work to do."
"Don't tell me. Tell him," said Audrey, nodding to a clean-cut young man emerging from the building. He was wearing a navy blue sweater, matching slacks, and a heavily padded jacket, which looked like it covered body armor, marked Police, HSI. Audrey snapped on her most radiant smile and gave him an absurd wave that made her look like a distressed starlet from a 50s screwball comedy.
"You gonna shout yoo-hoo?" Tamika asked. "Complete the picture."
Audrey stuck her tongue out at her, but recovered the smile as the hunk swaggered into earshot.
"The boss," said Audrey, by way of introduction. "Tamika Mars. I don't think I caught your name."
"Miss Mars," said the young man, apparently immune to Audrey's charms. "I'm Agent Cook with Homeland Security Investigations, Special Response Team. Mind if I ask you a few questions?" He was addressing the three of them.
"Here?"
asked Tamika, considering his badge. "We can sit in the park if you like," said the policeman. "It may be some time before the building has been cleared. The team is already in." Tamika glanced up and down the street. Mrs. Singh, at the nail salon next door,
was arranging a special offer display in the window.
Sure, she said. What do you need?
Marvin's face was pale, and he was breathing shallowly.
Have you had any threats lately? Asked the cop. I believe you run a controversial website.
Tamika gave her principal reporter a look. Controversial was an Audrey word, designed to make the journalism sound edgy.
No more than usual, she answered. Nothing serious.
Any unexpected deliveries?
The agent had plucked out a notepad and chose this moment to look down at it.
It was probably nothing. But for a split second, Tamika felt sure he had avoided her eyes. She shook her head, feeling the weight of the strange notebook in her coat pocket. Marvin opened his mouth, his face a comic mask of confusion, but said nothing.
Nothing yesterday, she said. Bills and junk, the usual.
Bad today?
It's 10 o'clock in the morning, man, she said. Mail doesn't arrive until 2.
Right, said the cop. And no hand deliveries?
Hand deliveries?
Asked Tamika, with more hauteur than she felt.
What do you think I'm running here, a trading post?
No, ma'am, said the agent, offering her a card. My number, if anything occurs to you. We should have you in again in 2 or 3 hours.
2 or 3 hours? Tamika said. What am I supposed to do until then? Can I at least get my laptop?
What does it look like?
Like a laptop, she said, marching toward the door. Come on, I'll show you.
Can I get a card, too? Audrey cooed. In case anything occurs to me?
Yes, ma'am, said the cop, fishing in his jacket pocket, as Tamika opened the door and made for the stairs.
As she walked, she stared straight ahead, saying nothing, but thinking furiously.
Tamika was used to sniffing out BS on a daily basis, and Dion said she was naturally suspicious, untrusting. But it had to be more than that. Everything about this felt wrong.
Letting a civilian back into a building that was being searched for a bomb? Not closing down the street? Not leading the people in the vegetarian restaurant, or the opticians, or the nail salon to safety behind a perimeter of brightly colored police tape? 2 guys performing the inspection with no support team, no vehicles, no protective gear? Either they didn't really expect to find a bomb, in which case she was being messed around for no good reason, or something else was going on entirely. Whatever it was, she sure as hell wasn't about to leave her computer behind. She entered the office without apology, hearing Cook clattering up the stairs behind her. Another uniformed man, broad-shouldered and sporting a crew cut, stood up quickly behind Audrey's desk, eyes lasering in on her, his right hand moving to the holstered pistol at his hip. He froze when she saw him, not relaxing until Agent Cook said, "She works here. Just getting her laptop." His voice was careful, as if he were saying more than the words alone suggested. Tamika suddenly felt uncomfortable with him behind her.
What the hell was this?
For a moment, she felt panic encroaching at the edges of her consciousness. She half-turned and gave him a smile, as if nothing could be more normal. She made a show of folding the laptop closed and slipping it into its case, like a magician showing his audience he has nothing up his sleeve. The handwritten notebook that had been dropped that morning, that was what they were looking for. She was sure of it. Why, God knew. But this was no bomb squad.
When can we get back in? She asked, as perky as she could muster. I've got a ton of stuff to get through.
We'll be done by noon, said Cook. Hopefully sooner, so stay close.
Great, she said,
holding up the laptop like a shield as she made for the door. I'll wait for you outside.
Hold it, said the man by Audrey's desk.
She felt the urge to run, but stifled it and turned.
Your co-workers need to get any of their stuff, too? Asked the second man.
Tamika breathed.
No, and they aren't my co-workers, she said, finding a little swagger as she marched out. This ain't no damn commune. They work for me.
Marvin and Audrey were waiting for her on the pavement outside, watching the building warily, as if half expecting it to erupt into flames any minute.
Is it me? Said Audrey. Or did that feel really weird?
It's not you, said Tamika, cinching her long red coat a little tighter. Let's take a walk. It was early spring, but still cold. The trees were bare and stark, as if all color had been drained from the square. At least there was no snow on the ground.
So what do we think? Marvin asked, scared out of his stoner glaze. Not cops, right?
Right, said Tamika, flicking the absurd wig out of her face. She wished she hadn't worn it. It had been a private joke with Dion. That seemed like a very long time ago now.
Daily News? The Post? Audrey suggested.
Tamika scowled, but said nothing. It wouldn't be the first time a tabloid had tried to poach a story from her. But she knew most of their reporters personally, and these two were new to her. She pictured the way the one with the crew cut had watched her from behind her desk, the way his hand had strayed to his gun when she walked in. No, she didn't know who they were, but she was prepared to bet her last dollar that these guys weren't reporters. She was also prepared to bet she knew what they were looking for. Though she complained about them from time to time, Tamika trusted Marvin and Audrey completely.
They want this, she said. I don't know why, but I'm not going back until I've read it. See what might be worth a stunt this crazy.
Audrey nodded.
First things first, Tamika said. Let's find a copy shop. If someone's going to try to steal it, we could use a backup. And since I work best with caramel macchiato inside me, I suggest East Side Copy on 13th, and then Joe's.
Sounds like a plan, said Audrey.
A flock of pigeons ballooned into the air on their left, wings clapping. Tamika, who disliked birds, winced and shielded her face, turning back the way they had come. And that was how she saw them. Cook and the other man in their HSI uniforms, moving purposefully towards her, watching her, then breaking into a run as soon as they realized they'd been spotted.
They're coming,
Tamika gasped. The one with the crew cut was reaching for his weapon.
Go,
said Marvin, with none of his usual flapping indecisiveness.
Run!
She met Audrey's eyes, saw the fractional nod of agreement, and broke into a plunging dash along the path toward the subway station. Behind her, someone shouted, though she couldn't catch the words. In front of her, a bicycle courier swerved and spilled onto the grass as she barged through. A woman with a baby carriage cursed her, and businessmen stared as if they'd never seen the like before. And then there was a pop, and an almost instantaneous answering bang from a mailbox yards in front of her, a neat hole punching through the steel. They were shooting at her. A cry went up behind her, a rising wail of panicked horror. As she turned, she saw the path behind her clearing as people flung themselves to the ground. For a second, she saw the gunman clearly. He was perhaps 100 yards behind her, weapon raised and sighted. She saw the muzzle flash before she heard the report, heard the zip of the bullet through the air beside her head, and then saw the gunman crumple under Marvin's inexpert sideswiping tackle. The two men went down together. Tamika started back towards them.
God, she thought, God!
But then she saw Audrey screaming at her to go, and she began to run again, though now her legs felt like they were made of iron and concrete.
Oh, God! Marvin!
The subway was behind her. She glanced back, heading south on University past the fancy furniture store, and when she could no longer see behind her, turned quickly onto 11th Street, forcing herself into a steady trot. She was wearing the wrong heels for running. Turn her ankle, and she may as well go back and hand them the book.
Pace yourself.
Marvin wouldn't be able to handle himself in a fight. The crowd would think he was attacking a policeman.
Keep going. She should have just given them the damn book. What was it anyway? Some crackpot scrapbook of made-up history designed to get his idiot name into the Twitterverse? It was absurd.
There were no alleys to duck into. Desperation mounting, she risked a look back. The man who had called himself Cook had stopped and was looking her way, talking into a radio attached to the shoulder of his jacket. It meant there were more of them.
Tamika scanned the street corner, fishing her phone from her pocket and unsteadily thumbing on her GPS. She was looking for a cop, but stopped herself. Any uniform in the area might be working with Cook. By now, back in the park, someone would have called 911. Legitimate police were surely on their way. Ironically, that meant the safest place might be back where she had come from, if she could elude the imposters pursuing her. There was also her car, but it felt like it was parked 100 miles away. She made a hard right and stepped into the first store she saw. She thought it was a dry cleaner's, judging by the hanging plastic-covered garments. But then she saw dressmaker's mannequins, a long counter with a built-in yardstick, and racks holding bolts of fabric. An elderly Asian lady looked up from her sewing machine expectantly. "You got a rear exit?" Tamika asked. The woman's face tightened. "You gonna buy something?" "Kind of in a rush," said Tamika, checking the door behind her. "What I look like?" asked the old woman grumpily. "Trying to make living here." Tamika pulled her wallet from her coat without breaking stride, tore out a 5 and flung it on the counter as she sped by. "To the back," said the woman, eyeing the bill. "Right, then green door on left." Tamika shouldered her way through the heaps of material and made it to the back just as the front door opened. Cook. She ducked around the corner and found the green door. It was bolted shut.